Välkomna till seminariet Framtidens internet. Jag som kommer vara moderator här under det här seminariet heter Hans Björgren. Och vi ska höra talarna Anders Rockström, Jeff Houston och Patrik Fällström. Inledande talare kommer vara Anders Rockström. Och jag kommer köra en kort presentation av varje talare. Jag gör den på engelska i och med att vi har en engelsk talare bland oss. Jag tror även att samtliga talare kommer hålla sina anföranden på engelska. Och har ni frågor så får ni räcka upp handen, så får jag komma springande med mikrofonen, i och med att det som sägs här idag ska bandas så att man både hör fråga och svar i sådana fall. Så, en presentation av Anders Rockström. Anders Rockström is currently with the corporate RD of Telesonera, working within a small staff unit for strategic renewal. The aim of this unit is to explore and understand the range of future opportunities and dangers in technology as well as in society and market. So, välkommen.
Okej, thank you. Jag tänkte jag prata på engelska också, så att om det är någon som protesterar så får vi göra sig synlig på något sätt. Okej, then I just try to make start my presentation here. Yeah? So, starting with a blank sheet. Well, the idea with my presentation here is basically to tell you. Okej. Jag trodde att den där fungerade. Getting a bit closer. Is that all right? Okay. My first message here is basically about the future internet. Well, we don't know. We just have to look into this type of crystal ball. And the only way to talk about this future is to basically to look what has happened and what is the situation right now. But the purpose right here now is basically to do a bit of problemizing about this and a little bit of sharing the internal discourse that we're having within the company. And it is, and I've been told to say this, it is not to present an official Telesonera view, because we just don't know what the future is about these things. And the role, as I said, of this small unit called Renewal within the corporate R&D is basically to form this type of discourse, to form this type of discussions. Okay. And the message before we turn this on is basically that what is forming the future is a bit like Jeff said, it is about what the user is doing and what technology will offer to you. Okay, with this talking about technology, right. So why? Starting off with that. Well, why are we doing this? Well, as a telecom operator, we can say that we have a track record. A track record of basically guessing wrong to a number of things. And this is, I mean, you stole my points earlier today, but it's all right. Just one part of the thing. But then the other hand is that we also tend to be taken by surprise. And most of the big businesses that we have today have surprised us. Internet as such was nothing that we planned. We have smaller things, for example, like the instance messaging systems within the mobile systems. All those things are taking us by surprise. So my intent is basically, like, could we try to do a better job, trying to find out where are we heading. So then, how to do this? Well, in order to do this, you need to have a method, 1, 2, 3. And the basics is basically observe where we are now, what happens, what are the trends, what are the actors and things like that. And then we have to make some conclusions from that, trying to understand where this could take us, what are the options, what are the basic drivers in that. And then you have, as always, step two is missing, which is the most difficult one, and that is actually to believe what we are seeing. And why things are tend to take us by surprise is basically because we do not assess all the things that everybody knows is true. Particularly within the business, when things are true, that those are the things that should be assessed. So then, starting with what is the situation today? Well, basically, if we take on the market, user, and money flow that we have today, we have definite flows like this that we can always see also in our results from our company. Basically, there is a flow of telephony and things like that from the fixed old plain old telephone services areas to the mobile, and there is a flow of the traffic from the POTS networks into the internet. And what was also interesting is that there is a definite flow from mobile towards the internet as we have it today. But what is also interesting is what the World Internet Institute found out when they're asking people those type of questions, if you are going to refrain from something, what are you going to select off first, or where are the options? And the interesting things are that internet is more important also as the entertainment in form of the television. And that means that we are probably entering some type of new situation. And the things that we have here is basically that the actors, the users, the customers are getting more active. I mean, on this scale, either you are saying that you're sitting home on your sofa as a couch potato being entertained, or you're being active yourself. And apparently people would choose being active. So that's one trend we can see. The other trend from an operator perspective is basically, if you take the expected revenues and take the OECD expectations, you can see that in just a few years, the total revenue of what we call telecom business today is basically going down to a level of 20-30%, something like that. And that means that in order to survive in this area, you could either downsize yourself very much, or you must find new areas of revenue. And that's basically what we are trying to find out. What are the new areas where we have the new revenue, the new usages? It's not just trying to be more cost-effective selling telecoms or being selling more telecoms, because that will not save us. And in that discussion, you have a number of opposites that people are discussing. You have the things about being open networks, having walled gardens, and we have some discussion on that previous today about IMS and things like that. We have, where's the money? Is it basically that you're providing infrastructure services, or let's say services? Is it content-based services that you are producing? And as somebody said also before that, you could try to find out who's making the big money today. We'll take, for example, the infrastructure services like power utilities. And you have the other things that will be discussed in this conference is that what about user-produced peer-to-peer things, and what about the couch potato approaches that we have. So that's the discourse that we have. Now then, we're going to talk about the driver dimensions, trying to find out what is actually making the wheels go round. And we can say that normally you talk about these two dimensions, saying that what does technology enable, what are you using it for, and how are you making some kind of money, making the things coming together. And what we can observe today is basically that when it comes to technology, we have more of technology than we need. That the quest today is basically to make use of technology, not to invent technology. And I have this small diagram over here because our origin, when we started, for example, with telecom, then the quest was that we were trying to get the technology that was not around. That's why we are specifying things. That's why we are trying to optimize things. But that is not the case anymore, because now we have more technology that we can make use of. But if we then start to try to specify what type of technology we will have, we probably end up finding out that we don't have that technology on the shelf, and then we are missing the opportunities. Then when it comes to usage, well, here we have the big changes that are coming ahead today. And that is a time change, and there's basically two big factors in this. One thing is that we're having much more competent users. competent from a technology point of view. They're having more competent gadgets back at home, and they're competent from a knowledge point of view. They can do things. And then what's actually fueling this is that we're having a very rapid development in the penetration of this. Then about business, well, that's the big question mark. Because most of the ISPs and things today, they are not making good business. Most of them are having somewhat red figures, or they have some black figures. They're not having big figures. So that is the big problem area. We must basically change the culture doing business. Then going a little bit back on technology, what we can see on technology is that we have a very rapid development. We have some type of more type pace in most technologies. They are doubling or something like that in a certain time period. And that means that we are, even if we have the surplus, we're having a fast refill in this, which means that we must have shorter and shorter depreciation times of the technology that we have. But we can also see, as technology tends to go in pace, if you do this for several technologies, it's not very difficult to make this type of technology maps, where we can see where the enabling windows for a number of things actually occur. But there are very few people are doing that. We're just looking backwards, but this is one way of actually looking forward in doing this. But the quest in this is basically just trying to see it and believe it and then seizing it. And the major general trend in this is what we see that what used to be, I mean, networks is basically some kind of optimization. You are sharing resources because you can't afford it yourself. That's why you're having a network. And what is happening now is basically that the end users, the endpoints, the terminals, are getting more powerful and are developing faster than actually the network is. One way of describing this is they're saying that we need dumber and dumber networks, this is the lowest common denominator and things like that, but also that we are doing more, the production facilities is going over to the terminals. And that means that we actually have a new production paradigms, which is a bit difficult for us as operators to actually grasp. And for example, Skype is a very good example. Normally, Skype is seen as a good example as now actually voice over IP is taking speed and getting accepted. But the interesting part with Skype is basically that we're taking what is used to be a network service, a network-produced service, and you produce that in the terminals. So you move the production from the network to the users. And we see a number of those things is coming on. I heard that the people behind CASA, etc., they're planning to do something very rapidly and expecting next month, something like that, that similar things are coming out for in the video area. And you can see basically that the things that we have been specifying in IETF, broadcast, multicast, and things like that, you do that with the terminals as such. They're overruling also the typical standards people that we're having in internet as well. Okay, and then what also is something that is enabled by technology is that the surplus, it actually enables divergence rather than convergence because you can afford it. And the reasons for doing this divergence is basically you're doing it simpler and you're gaining performance. And typically you can talk about these type of Lambda services when you, for example, are going to distribute all the data from CERN, things like that. They do not package this into IP packets, send it away over the network and unpack it. They're just hiring up these wavelengths and they connect in the size together. You have the same for contribution. If you're having very high resolution pictures, why should you package them on the IP? Still, of course, we have an IP convergence being a very good denominator if you don't have any other choice. Another example of doing that is basically that we made a trial for a year up in Dalarna in Sweden using this type of wavelength technology, and we actually found good new ways of producing the social services that in these areas. And it's true that using this technology today, it was too cheap. So basically, instead of having clerks going around to different places. It was the employment services of that area going around to different parts that just made black figures. It was positive results just for half a year applying this technology instead of letting people do all the travel. So what you can see is that we have a heterogeneity of networks coming on, and we have already had that in one case, but we are seeing that, and we should actually accept that we are doing that. And we can see that we have this IP convergence complemented with divergence. And interoperability, yes, but when we need it. We actually don't need interoperability between all the type of things that we have today. Then about usage. Well, what you can see about the internet, the penetration, who and how. We can see these are the figures from PTS 1 year ago, something like that. But you can see that in general, the internet accesses as such. We have been developing rather fast, and I mean the public internet starting off basically 95, something like that, and going on. It has reached a rather good penetration. But what the first penetration is basically what we can say, it is not real internet, some kind of peephole, dial-up, or whatever you call it. But you can use it for information. It's good, in that perspective. And for a number of services, you can do your internet banking and things like that. What's coming on is then the second generation, where the basic difference is that it is always on. It enables a bit of peer-to-peer services, etc., but it has piggybacked on telecoms. It's normally that you have a strong asymmetry and things like that in the services. And then the third generation, adding on capacity, and you're using more, let's say, true datacom technology in doing that, then you can say that going from some kind of tourist on a network, you're being network residents. And that then you have a travel between being passive users and being active users, being producers or just being consumers on the network. And that is something that is changing how people are using the internet. And then you can basically see this in this way. This is one way of seeing it, saying that, well, what we made is basically some kind of penetration detour. Because starting out with pure internet, end-to-end and all the high principles that we had, what we made, you said piggybacking the telephony. What we have is basically using the telephony infrastructure that we had, we're starting off with this first generation. And then hopefully when we're coming back in third generation, coming back to the roots, at least that is what people are saying. But then, as you see, you have 1, 3, you're still missing 2 in between. You have twilight zone in between. And we don't really know what's happened there. There are strong forces in that direction because we have, I mean, here we have all the things of triple play and things like that when we are trying to make this. So here's the fight. We hope, well, at least I could hope, that we are going in the right direction, but there are a number of things going in the other directions. Next thing about usage is that we do have a number of societal challenges coming on. We have, for example, the aging population and things like that. We have environmental problems. A lot of things of sustainability. But in that area, ICT is a very natural tool to solve those. I mean, what is sustainability? Well, we have environmental issues, we have a sustainable economy, we have, say, a sustainable social society and things like that. But typically, if you have a problem with CO2, with physical travels, well, virtual meetings are more friendly to the environment than our physical travels and things like that. So ICT becomes a very natural tool in this area to go further. But then we have some problems in doing that. Dataföreningen in Sweden made some kind of report a while ago and contained a number of things. But one very interesting thing is that when it comes to this type of penetration, you can see that today, when it comes to this third generation, basically, you can say a third of the population have it. Another third would like to have it. But the problem is that one third doesn't want it. If you want to have this as a critical infrastructure in society, you must need at least 90-95%. Oh, 5 minutes. I have to talk faster. But then, could we then build this society by subventioning? Well, you have 2 examples. One example is, for example, what we have done in the network building in Sweden, when building building fiber structures and subvention this type. What is happening? Well, basically, taking the Telia network, taking some of the other fiber networks, another fiber network as well, it basically means that what we have failed in that type of subvention is that we have just replicated structures already there. We have not gained any higher access to internet, anything like that. But we have a good example of subventioning. We have the PC reform that we had in Sweden, which was basically made by mishap. But we had basically a tax deduction scheme for getting PCs in the homes, and we had a very drastic high raise of this access. But I think if we're going to do that, we should accept, see that we have, if we're going to go further, I think user subventions, is, as they are in the driver's seat, they're much more productive than producer subventions in this area, because they tend to be more politically correct. Then coming back to business modeling. Well, what is stopping us here? Is basically, we know the technology, we know economics, we know a number of things. It's basically legacy, our own culture, and regulation. And I always like to have this type of picture. I mean, today, the incumbents, at least the big operators, tend to be very much internally hype-driven. We talk about convergence, seamlessness, engineering, what have you. And this picture has been around with for the last 10 years. But this is something that reminds you very much about teenagers and sex. I mean, everybody's talking about it. Few have the actual experience. And those who had, they were mostly failures in doing that. And that. But that doesn't discourage us. We continue on those lines. This is something we have to learn. No, but what do we have to do in this area? Well, we have basically learned new operator roles. And we have to make new type of business logics in doing this. And doing that, I mean, we can't do that on our own. We have to involve the users very heavily in doing that. And all the other stakeholders, like, for example, the society, welfare production, and things like that. So where we're heading? Well, we're having complementing divergence. I think that's important. Openness, yes, we hope, but there are very strong counterforces in this area, from the terrorist fighting and things like that, and the IPRs holders. But let's hope for it. But then we have the user drive in this. That means that the user becomes the producers, we have peer-to-peer, the user produces the content and things like that. And then we have that this, if we are getting penetration, if we can overcome the last third, we have actually this critical societal infrastructure. And will we tell you Sonera over there? Well, I think so, hope so. Big companies tend to survive. I don't know why, but they tend to do that. But then we have to do a bit of renewal, involve users, partners, and doing new business models. Did I make it on time? Thank you.
Tack så mycket, Anders. Så till nästa talare, Jeff Houston. Can I do a brief introduction of Jeff? Jeff Houston is the chief scientist at the Asia-Pacific Network Information Center, one of the regional internet registers. Prior to joining APNIC, he served a 10-year sentence at Telstra, and before that he was active in the Australian academic research networking community. He has a long-standing fascination with the internet and its technology. Welcome.
Thank you, and good morning again. Again, I'm in English. I'm sorry, but I hope for your understanding there. There are two kinds of internet presentations, and you've seen one before. I think it was the gentleman from Ericsson. Slide starting at the bottom left, rocketing up to the top right. Yes, endless optimism, brave new future, wonderful world, it only gets bigger and better. Yep. And there's the other kind of presentation, which I now know what to call it. Thank you very much. These are the Twilight Zone presentations. The ones that are in this weird half-life that show things going up and hitting a wall. This is not new. In fact, I've seen this for as long as I've been on the internet, where someone says the end of the internet predicted something at 11. It used to be news, then it turned into GIFs and MPEGs. These days, it's the torrent at 11. So this is a twilight presentation about the end of the internet as we knew it. There are many ways of telling the future, aren't there? And they go back as long as there's been civilization and longer. In Chad, they put a mud crab in a bowl and then let it get out and watch where it wanders. Or you can get out your favourite Excel spreadsheet and do predictions going ever upward to the top right. Yep. Or you can do tarot cards, but the one I like most comes from China. It's actually the earliest form of Chinese writing. It dates back to the Shang dynasty of 1200 BC. You got a tortoise shell and you inscribed possible futures. And then you put the shell onto a fire, in fact onto the embers. And with a damn fine crack, a line would appear in the shell, because the heat would make the shell weaken. It would crack in one line, and wherever the line pointed to, that text was the future. Worked well, hey. So let's ask the Oracle Bone a few questions about where we're going, and in particular, I want to talk about IPv4. And there are a number of questions that I think should perhaps concern you, particularly if you're working in this industry. When's it going to run out? Well, maybe that's not quite the right question. There's sort of, you know, there are people still coding COBOL and Fortran out there, poor buggers. So exhaustion isn't exactly a clean break with the past. So maybe we should refine this a little bit. When will the last V4 protocol stack get turned off? When will it simply become irrelevant, just like ISDN or ATM? When will it become just not commercially viable anymore as a service platform? Or maybe a more specific question, when will there be no more IPv4 addresses? Or perhaps, when will this entire network be so overwhelmed by network address translators that the entire issue of a network address becomes irrelevant? So what's exhaustion? Well, I don't think we're ever going to turn it off. A bit like Fortran, you know, it's sticky. The past is always sticky. You can never quite get it off your shoe. And my view is you're going to be routing it for decades to come, because there are people out there still running Windows 3.1. Jeez. So I think V4 will be around for some time, but there is quite a specific question here. When you go in this particular area of the world off to the ripe NCC and say, look, my network's getting bigger, give me more addresses, and you pay your 7,000 euro, your 14,000 krona, and you get more addresses. Cheap, easy, demonstrate the need, you get addresses. When will that stop? Come to a complete halt. Pretty soon. If all of you decide that it's all running out and you all ring up the ripe NCC tomorrow, we'll probably run out the day after. But of course, you're nice people and you all do an orderly queue even when the bank's running out of money. If you're all nice to each other, it'll probably last maybe to 2012, but if you ever start to panic sometime in the next 2 years, as you probably will, it'll happen a lot sooner. And of course, when will IANA run out? About the same time. So the supply model is about to break. So why is that a problem? No more V4 addresses? You've all got one? Not a problem, eh? Well, we've adopted a very strange distribution model. And the reason why you can't buy and sell addresses is that someone's giving it away for so close to free, it doesn't matter. The regional registries basically prevent trading by giving it away. So when they've got nothing more to give away, which will happen pretty soon, where are your addresses going to come from? Or you're all of a sudden going to say, right, that's it. No more 3G on IP, no more IPMs, whatever, no more growth. What we have is what we've got. Of course you're not. Growth will still happen. But now you're going to have to look elsewhere for your addresses. You're going to have to find someone who is willing to sell them. And of course, any student of economics immediately learns one thing. When demand exceeds supply, the price goes up. So when we get into scarcity, sometime around 2009 to 2012, we're going to see pricing pressure on IPv4 addresses, because the only place you're going to get them is from the person sitting next to you. This is price escalation. How expensive can it get? Don't know. It's up to you. I'm like, how much is your house worth? When you sell it, you'll find out. How expensive could it get? Well, 20,000 kroner, I think, is the equivalent for a single IPv4/32. In other words, one address is not out of the question. 20,000 kroner per single address. That's a lot of money. That's a huge amount of money. Someone's going to have to pay. And the people who are going to have to pay are firstly the industry, but the industry doesn't mint money. You, the consumer, give them your money. So the costs will go up. End consumers are going to be faced with this. Now, markets are amoral. They're not fair. They're not equitable. The highest bidder wins. So what about Botswana? What about even China or India? What about the principles of a global internet when buying and selling of addresses tends to aggregate the address into the one who can pay the most? So let's start thinking about what this implies, because it's not necessarily the case that you've only got one option. I think you've got three. You've got NATs. You got them today. We've got trading markets. Or perhaps, just perhaps, there's IPv6. What do they look like? NATs. We could deploy more. Geez, we're doing a damn fine job of deploying them now. Why do we deploy them? Because the cost, from a network provider's viewpoint, is externalized. Who pays for the NAT? You do. The provider simply ships, you know, DHCP and hands out one address. You pay for the device that actually NATs the rest of your house, the rest of your business, anything else. So from a provider's point of view, this is as good as it gets. This is externalizing a cost point. So what services can't be offered? That's really interesting. Because these days, if I want to create a service and it doesn't work through NATs, it's dead. Look at Skype. Does Skype work through NATs? Yes. Look at Torrent. Does Torrent work through NATs? Yes. Look at every major application, including our friends at Google and the rest. Do they work through NATs? Yes, deliberately. Because a massive amount of the internet sits behind NATs. So the real question is this the future forever? Interesting question. Next 5 years? Yeah, probably. Because again, the deployment costs are pushed out. So you externalise the cost and they're just fine. And the they support a viable subset of internet services, and I would actually argue in a world of NATs, they have to support every internet service that's ever going to operate, because if it doesn't operate through a NAT, there's no point deploying it. So now, most of the applications that you actually have a fair amount of complexity inside them to deal with navigation through NATs, and we have a lot of experience of them. I guess that most of you are behind a NAT already at home, yes? You're all on Network 10, yeah? Hotel room I'm in, certainly there. And they've already influenced applications already. Speak Freely disappeared. Skype came up. Why? Because Skype works through NATs. But what about the long term? What about the million, billion, trillion device world? What about thinking about in decades? NATs are a problem. NATs are a problem because the standards world failed us. There is no standard for a NAT. There never was. The IETF, in a view of architectural purity, first defined NATs in 1994 and then decided they wouldn't standardise their behaviour because they were impure, dirty, grubby, and not conformant to the architecture. So here's this poor person sitting somewhere at his screen writing a software for the next model of NATs. What material does he use to write his NAT software? Creativity. Every NAT is different. Even the same manufacturer, different models have different behaviours. Even the same model has different behaviours in different firmware. NATs are a problem because they're not uniform. But okay, if I fix that, if we can make some standards for NATs and get the NAT world to sort of agree that there's one way of doing it, there's another problem, and it's complexity bloat at the application. Once you start introducing NATs, who are you becomes a really tough problem because the address doesn't help. So like Skype, you have to invent identity domains that sit above the network's underlying address structure. That's tough. And for NATs to work, you need rendezvous with multiple parties. That's tough. You need multi-gang NAT behavior, because my NAT might be behind your NAT, might be behind someone else's NAT, and so on. That's really tough. And then if you want to do security through all this, give up. So there's no easy fix for complexity bloat. Over the decades, I don't think NAT's going to be enough. It's a short-term convenience. It's tactics, but it's not strategy. Ooh, running out of choices. How about trading? Well, you know, we're great at national markets. We have national regulators, national governments, national security commissions, national everything. What about internationally? What about globally? Almost nothing. So how does such a market operate globally? What's the speculation on pricing? How high can the price get? And can we route the outcomes, or will the entire routing space blow up in our face? Certainly the economics is fine. Supply, demand, cost. More supply, less demand, price comes down. Oil came down last week. Lots of demand, little supply, price goes up. This is fine. Why does someone sell? Convert the asset into money. Why does someone buy? Because they see a value in that resource. Typical stuff. But the risks are hard. They're hard in an international context. They're hard in terms of people actually deploying money to distort the market, hoarding. Price uncertainty. How much will the address cost tomorrow? The futures market. Are there captive buyers, people who simply have no choice? What about speculative players who start trading in fundamental network identity, i.e. address, simply to see what the price is going to be tomorrow? What is the poor regulator going to do? How much hair will they rip out collectively? My suspicion is tons. And of course, will the routing load take it? I doubt it. So, you know, will a market work in the short term? Will it be better? Because by 2009, you've got a problem. And about the only way you're going to fuel your growth expectations for your product for 2009 for a few more years is you've got to buy it from your neighbour. So, yes, I think it's quite a conventional mechanism, and I think it'll probably work for a while, and price signals may well work. But there are massive implications at both a regulatory and a technical level. So when you look at the long term, I don't think it'll work. And the bottom line is really the killer. You can't make this scale forever. Markets don't make the finite infinite. If you've got a shortfall of addresses, you've got a shortfall of addresses no matter which way they're distributed. So frankly, in the very long term, you've got to move away. You've got to move out of this kind of market. Because if you really do have to pay 20,000 Swedish kronas for each single slash 32, how much is the old class B's, a slash 16 worth? 65,000 times 20,000. You start to realise that addresses could reach a price that is untenable. So at some point you need to slide away from this. At some point, maybe you need to look at this. V6. There's only consumer money in this industry. You can't make your own. Now, the consumer has email, has the web, has their torrents, has their NATs. So, what's the proposition with V6? A, does a consumer even understand the difference? And B, would they pay more? Puh. They won't. So it's going to cost, and it's going to take a lot more time than 2 years for an industry that is stuck in a business rut to get out of this. And consumers don't want to pay for it, and they don't want to transition. So there's a real issue flying around with V6. And in the short term, I would suggest that it's not very viable, not from a business sense. There's no commercial incentives. If anyone, Telia Sonera, my old mates at Telstra, decided to run V6 as a parallel network service to their customers, it's all cost. There is no revenue. At $20 a month per DSL, there is no revenue. It's all negative. Even the first phone call to the help desk, you've lost 2 years of revenue. So how are you going to fund V6? You can't. Can you externalize it in the same way you externalize gnats? No, the cost is with you. There's no service base. There's no applications. People stopped writing coherent end-to-end years ago. So in the short term, you're in a very, very small room and there are no lights. And you're all alone. Welcome to the Twilight Zone. Now, you can't trade V4 forever. You can't run gnats forever. And quite frankly, it'll take forever to write a new protocol other than V6. Like it or not, you have no alternative. There is only one door out of that room, and it is labelled V6. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on where you sit, there's no other way through. Yes, in theory, you can make larger networks with better utility models. In theory, you can make the world a better place than what you have with gnats at the moment. But it's all long-term. It all looks much, much further than the current players are looking with their money. So here's this real issue of there's an attractive place over the hill somewhere, but you just can't quite figure out how to get from where you are to where you want to be. So we get back to the last question on the Oracle bone. What does it mean? There's no flag day. You're never, ever going to make this industry move all at once. It's never going to. It is way too big for that. And you're going to have V4 trading. That's obvious. But that'll continue to be in demand well beyond where the RIRs exhaust themselves. That's easy. But the price will change. The source will change. Their value will change. And I kind of wonder about those people in Botswana, whether they might find it more economically attractive to sell every last address they have to you rich Western Europeans and go back to the postal and the telephone system, because they will make a whole heap of money from their addresses that they otherwise couldn't make. Is this fair? Is this reasonable? Is this what we want? I don't think so, but I'm not sure how we're going to get around it. This is a tough problem. And of course, from the service provider, I'm actually loading them up with the worst possible problem. For that same $20 a month, they're now running three kinds of distinct networks. And if they choose to indulge in MPLS fantasies, 4, 5, 6 or even 500, that running IPv4 in a market sense, having to pay quite significant amounts for addresses, and supporting a whole bunch of NAT-based deployments, and supporting V6, is untenable. It's just too many dollars. That's tough. So I don't know who you are, but I suspect that some of these three categories roughly correlate to a lot of you in this room. If you're managing a network and your product managers are saying, I want to roll out this product over the next 5 years and it's going to do mobile, cellular, whatever wonderful things and it's all going to work on V4, the real feedback should be, and how much are you willing to actually pay for your addresses? Understand the growth requirements and match that to address accessibility, because it may not work. Quite frankly, as a network manager, you need to think well beyond the next 3 months. You actually need to look at this from a perspective of what's going to happen over 5 years, because this is inevitable in terms of exhaustion. What if you work for someone like Cisco, someone like Ericsson, someone on the supply side, or someone actually right within the products of the ISP industry? Well, you know, you've got to do something really radical for that industry. You've actually got to build products that meet future demand, not past demand. As Cisco got bigger and bigger, and I think it's no surprise to any of you, rather than having a conversation that went, that's cool, I'll see if we can build it, the conversation now goes, well, you know, you're the first customer to ask for this. When another 100 others ask, maybe we might consider it. In other words, the larger you get, the more you lag rather than lead. And that's not going to work. In this particular situation, you actually need to plan ahead. Novel concept. Any surprise in an industry is a problem. And addresses leaping from negligibly zero up to a serious price is a surprise for the industry. They're not going to like it. And they are going to complain. And they're worth billions and billions of kroner globally. So when they complain, people will listen, regulators will listen, governments will listen. There is a surprise and it is inevitable. And if you are on the listening side, if you are in the regulator and policy area, then you have an extraordinary problem. Because trying to figure out how to guide the industry through a regulatory light touch is going to be a real issue. How to actually phrase objectives that give clear goals to players, unambiguous signals to this industry that they need to look further forward in the next 6 months. This is tough. You know, you can't plan through this all the way. I can't, you can't. We've tried on a few things and we've never actually managed to make it work. It will be disruptive, it will be messy, it won't be seamless, and it won't be costless. Hopefully, that disruption won't come as a surprise. But it will. Of course it will. We've gone through a number of these over the years. And you know, you go through the standard issues. The sky is falling. Denial. No, it's not. Panic. Oh my God, the sky really is falling. Then you get to anger. Bloody hell, why is the sky falling? I am mad. Then you get to blame shifting. It's your fault the sky is falling. I've been good. That doesn't work either. So then it's into bargaining. What do I need to do to make the sky fall on you and not me? Okay, so the sky falls. Acceptance. Damn it, it fell. And then you move on. Recovery. But then you get to revisionism. Oh, I knew it all along. No panic, no problem. Where are you? You're here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. So, the next speaker will be Patrick Fellström. Patrick is currently a senior consulting engineer with Cisco Systems and the team Strategic Alliance. Mr. Fellström is involved in many things touching domain name system. He has been working with Unix since 1985 and been involved in internet-related standardization since 1989, both in Sweden and worldwide. Welcome on.
So let's see if this projector works. There. So let's see. And the presentation is somewhere around here. I'm doing too many things at the same time. I'm sorry. There. So I was asked to talk a little bit about the future of the internet and what I think is going to happen. And one of the questions, of course, that was listed on the agenda is whether we should improve what we have today or whether we have to replace it. Well, first of all, this is a picture, a photo I took the other day when taking the extremely long SAS flight from Gothenburg to Copenhagen. It was 30 minutes in the air. It took 15 minutes to taxi out of the runway. It took 20 minutes to taxi in Copenhagen, and then people had to wait 25 minutes for the bags. So there are other things than the internet that is not optimal. And by the way, that is where the internet is. So I had to follow the arrows and actually found the internet after a while. Okay, so what is it I'm doing? I probably know many of you, but I work for Cisco Systems in the US. I don't work for the Swedish organization, so which makes a little bit of difference, but not much. I have a small company here in Europe, here in Sweden, work with standardization, as we heard, and I'm trying to have fun and try to do all different kind of things. Okay, some important background here that I think is really important to remember. The first one is that everything is a computer. Everything will be a computer in the future, and of course, all computers will be connected to the internet. So your TV, your phone, your address book, your agenda, your microwave, your car, everything you have will be connected to the internet. Everything will be network computer. And so far, of course, only a very, very small number of items are actually connected to the internet. So regarding address consumption thing that Jeff is talking about, I think when we are trying to get IP addresses to everything in the world, we will have a slightly higher request for IP addresses. I was working in the IETF for a while together with a friend of Jeff and myself that works for Chrysler. And as you know, the cars nowadays have a bus internally, so the various things in the car actually communicate with each other using addressing, like packet-based networks inside the car. And what he wanted, what he came to the IETF was, not only did he want a NAT box between the car and the gas station where the car rolls in, so the gas station automatically could talk with, like, to check whether the headlight was on and off and check the oil level, etc. He actually wanted all cars to have a unique address space. Okay. And everyone can laugh about that and say, oh, we don't need that, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Next example. So they're actually going to use a NAT for the cars, so they don't have to talk with the cars while they're out driving, etc. So you have a slightly less number of IP addresses you need for the car industry than what they were thinking 10 years ago. Second example, you heard about the Boeing 787 that is supposed to be able to take off in the spring of 2007. You know that they started writing the code for some of the networking gear like a month ago? This is actually kind of interesting. When they design an airplane, they start by saying, okay, it has to be this big, the door is supposed to be this high up from the ground because they need to fit. You cannot rebuild all airports just because they build a new airplane. Of course, Airbus sort of think that. But anyways, so this is the size of the airplane. To be able to fly, it needs to have this shape. And then, after a while, after working with the design, they're, now let's write the software for this. Which might not be a bad thing to actually do, because then you have real requirements on the software, something that the software industry has not seen so far. But what they really want to do, you might have been flying with Lufthansa or SAS, and you had the wireless on board, and everything is nice, and you can connect to the internet, and you don't get a single moment when people don't call you. Anyways, remember the business model for this connection by Boeing. That is not to give the passengers internet. It is for Boeing and General Electric and Rolls-Royce to talk with the devices on the plane all the time. Okay? They want to monitor the engine all the time. And if you know the calculation that a normal airline company do for example, let's say you have a Boeing 777. If you have to have that plane on the ground for 24 hours, that's a lot of money. That pays the internet connectivity from the plane. Okay. So the next thing to remember is that the internet belongs to all of us. And this is also something that people don't forget. You see all these network diagrams we have. Here's me, here's my ISP, and over there is the internet. Okay. In reality, when you connect your laptop to something that is connected to the internet, your laptop and the network close to you ends up being part of the internet. So each one of us have to share the responsibility of making sure that the internet works. So increasingly, each one of us run a piece of the infrastructure. The next thing, one way of looking at convergence, is to see that there is no difference between information and software. Anyone that have tried to make an HTML page in Vue or Emacs know that what's the difference between that and writing a software in C? Well, HTML is slightly less structured, so it's actually easier to write the software that generates the HTML, at least for programmers like me. It's much, much easier to program than to create information. So the only difference between software and information might be the speed with the deployment speed. But of course, if anyone can distribute, can create information, everyone can create software, anyone can also distribute the software. Think about how fast Skype has deployed. Think about how fast the latest virus was deployed. Okay? And then look at all these poor players, like Jeff was talking about this morning, that try to deploy nice triple play services for a potential 10,000 customer base. I'm sorry. That is a business case that is doomed to die. So the only question to ask for the future is not who is owning the internet, who is owning the computer. Instead, who can install information on your computer and who can access your part of the internet? That's the only question. It's only a question on deployment time. Nothing else. And then if you look at the regulation, which I work with quite a lot, I spend quite a large amount of time in Stockholm and Brussels and other places. So one of the big problems we have for the future is that historically we know who can create information. The TV companies created TV programs. The radio companies created radio programs. We know who could create software. We knew who could deploy services. And because of that, we could make sure that TV regulation was aiming at the TV companies. We see that on the telephony regulation and also the latest European directive on data retention, it is only aiming at the telcos and alike licensed operators that sell services on the public market. So the whole train of regulation completely misses the point, misses the fact that anyone can create information, anyone can deploy services, anyone can create their own TV program, anyone can be a TV broadcasting station. Anyone can sell, anyone can deploy telephony. Do you think the telco regulation actually is do you think that if you put up your own SIP server at home, that the regulation is on you, that you have to fulfill those requirements? Forget that. So unfortunately, the regulation that we're working with, and even the new TV regulative, the TV directive that we have, Television Without Frontiers, it hopelessly behind. Telephony regulation, I'm sorry, no one is even looking at this. I've been trying in the Swedish government, I've been trying in the European Parliament to talk about these kind of things, and I'm sorry, no one is even, they try to ignore that the internet exists. We have the historical telco regulation, and then we have the next generation networks, whatever that is. Internet is something, it's like a nightmare, and the people hope that they wake up and it's gone. It was just a dream or something. Or if they understand that the internet works, they want to regulate to make sure that it goes away. Together with a hope that all of these people that deploy triple play and local city networks and the traditional telcos, that they will actually manage by business plans and business models and marketing forces, that they will actually make sure that you will not have any new players. But as Jeff explained, what the end user use are BitTorrent, Google services, and YouTube, which is now Google. So it doesn't matter what the other people are doing. Of course, there are individuals in the governments, individuals in the work for the European Commission. They work extremely hard. They believe in this. They have extremely low salary. And I'm amazed that they are still working there. But it's probably because they understand it and they want the world to be better. But for some reason, not enough is happening. So you individuals that work on these organizations and feel that I'm hitting at you, don't. I'm encouraging you. So the next thing is that everything is accessible all the time. Our previous IT minister, Ulrika Messing, very strongly said that mobility, that is when anyone can connect to the services they want, wherever they are, from whatever device they want. But even though the minister said this, even though the IT bill that we actually released in Sweden, which the parliament decided on, still we have organizations in Sweden that arrange conferences that talk about mobility, and with that they imply only using cell phones. Still you have organizations in the Swedish government that talk about mobile services and only talk about services using a cell phone. I don't know what else is needed in Sweden. We have a parliament decision and we have the minister standing up and defining what mobility is, and still people don't listen. So honestly, I don't know what to do. So I was on my way asking you, Jeff, this morning when you had all these slides talking about business cases, I was close to say Jeff, do you think, how many people in this room do you think really understood what you were talking about? So that means that we have a taxonomy problem, a terminology problem. Maybe we should not use the word mobility at all, just like we should not use the word next generation network either, because people mean different things with the term. So anyways, everything will be a network computer, everything will be connected to anything. Each one of us will run our own little piece of the internet. We have responsibility for our piece of the internet, and also, of course, we can create information. But then we have to remember some small, like, internet-related things. This is, like, core to my heart. John Postel, that unfortunately passed away too fast, was one of the persons that, one of the real persons that started working and working with the internet, said that in RFC 793, he said, be liberal in what you accept and conservative in what you send. And this is something that not enough people that define standards or write software or connect things to the internet remember. Really, really important. So I have a couple on this, and I think I have enough time. How many? 10 minutes, maybe? 10 minutes, okay. The first one, I like Mythbusters on Discovery, okay. So this is the first myth. Best effort is not good enough. How many times have you heard that? The internet is not good enough. We cannot run any real applications on the internet. Well, there are two problems with the statement, I think. First of all, what is a real application? People like the video quality on YouTube, obviously. So, like, what is... Anyways. And the second problem is, of course... I forgot the second thing. Anyways. If it is the case that people claim that the best effort that we have, system that we have on the internet, is not good enough. Okay. The problem here is that if you're an ISP and your customers produce, like, they want, for example, or produce, like, 5 gigabits of bandwidth, how do you think you should be able to make those customers happy? You only have two solutions. You either have to have 5 gigabits of available transmission, or you have to recognize your SLA and pay your customers or treat your customers well when they are complaining. None of the systems, QoS, DiffServ, MPLS, use any buzzword term you want, none of them create bandwidth for you. Okay. If you have 5 gigabits of bits, you need to have 5 gigabits of transmission, full stop. Okay. But, of course, different kind of traffic can have different needs. There are certain kind of traffic that, of course, are more sensitive to delay. So one way of not throwing away bandwidth is, of course, to increase the delay. That might be a bad thing. Either kind of traffic, of course, well, you don't want to have packets thrown away, but you don't mind having a little bit more delay. So you have different kind of traffic have different needs. You also do have bottlenecks here and there that you know about where they are. For example, like Jeff said here, that your DSL, your connection home is always full. Okay, I have done some other tricks in my connection at home, so it's not always full. I always have like a slot. But that's a known bottleneck. The access network will be a known bottleneck. Each ISP that build the network, just because the total amount of traffic like doubles every year again, it goes up really fast now. So every ISP that are upgrading the network, of course, do have bottlenecks in their network. And where you have the bottlenecks, of course you need to be able to have instructions on the endpoints of the bottleneck on what the routers should do if it is the case it has to throw away traffic. So QoS are instructions to devices in the network on what packets to throw away. That's QoS. And now what Curtis Lindquist has been saying all the time is that, oh, people want to have quality of service regardless of whether traffic is thrown away or not. Remember that it costs money to add quality of service, especially because you need to upgrade bandwidth. You need to double the available bandwidth every year anyway. So managing all of this stuff costs really money, real money, real people. So Curtis is saying, well, wait a second, you have to pay extra to get quality in the service in the network. And quality of service is instructions on what traffic to throw away. And now the $1 million question is, where do you find the customers that want to pay extra to have traffic thrown away? Okay. And I'm pointing out, I think it's so good, but I'm pointing out Curtis was the one saying this and not myself. So anyway, regarding best effort, modulo the bottlenecks, this thing is busted. Next thing, next generation network will solve all our problems. Okay? Remember that in the NGN world, as it is originally specified, operators do not exchange IP traffic. They exchange services. Each operator has at its border something called a session border controller. And yes, we sell those at Cisco. They sell really well. People want to buy them. They cost real money. And lots of it. It pays my salary. And sure, it might be the case that they are solving some kind of problem that people want. It solves many problems for people that want to build those business models of like trying to retain an income that they have today of traditional services. But it's not a long-term solution. Because long-term, as we have heard several times today, over-the-top services will win. People want plain IP packets because new services and evolution and innovation happens at the edge. So longer run, these session border controllers will be just a block. It will just be one of those known bottlenecks. So if you have one of those things and in the longer run, you suddenly have something that might throw away packets. Oh, you need to add quality of service. And you have this spiral that just goes down. Okay. So the only thing, though, that people have to remember is that what will be needed, if it is the case that the ISPs, which I hope they will have, different kind of SLAs, the ability to mark different kind of traffic that have different kind of needs. Of course, it's good if the ISPs can actually acknowledge each other's agreements and not only ship IP packets. It might be the case that it is a good thing, for example, if ISPs agree on diff serve labels or whatever. And of course, it might be the case that peering points for ISPs might be bottlenecks. So you need to take care of it just if it was a known bottleneck. But to have an NGN and SBC and those traditional world where the end user only can use the services that are turned on, I'm sorry, that is busted. Next thing, vertical integration in the future. Well, an operator needs to get back the investments to try to cross-subsidize. They will try to control what services the user uses because otherwise the user experience is not good enough. Have you heard about that? I heard about it several times, and so far I'm happy with what I have at home. And anyways, the local services actually compete with Google and stuff. How much do you think Skype is paying per potential customer? What is the production cost per customer of Skype? When you are deploying something that might like compete with Skype, think about that your production cost per customer must be as low as Skype. Okay? That's a little bit difficult to beat. Of course, you can give a better service and give a better user experience, but think about the production cost per customer. But in reality, also, it's very, very hard if it is the case that you build one of those vertically integrated systems. It might also be the case that to be able to get to, you also want to decrease the amount of churn, so you want to lock in the customer, make sure that he stays in your network. But that will, of course, make the customer unhappy, because when being at a conference like this, if there was like enough electricity on the floor, the customers might not be able to access the service at home. I hear from some of the people building these vertical systems, I hear that, well, a very, very good local service is the ability to online to book the room where you have the laundry in your apartment complex. For me, that's a typical global service, because if I'm at home, I can't go down there and see whether anyone is there. I want to access this thing when I'm at the office, so I know whether I should go home earlier from my office, from work. So many of the local services that people claim are local are actually in reality global. And the ability for people to reach their services wherever they are will increase. But we have to still remember that bundling is okay. We have to differentiate between bundling, because we must allow companies to sell many different kinds of things, as long as there is efficient competition for each one of the various services. And we are writing about this in the report that I will talk about in a minute. So this one is busted. The next thing, of course, here's a generic version of the talk that Jeff just held. I see so many things like this. There's a myth of, like, whatever. You have something that you measure on the y-axis that, like, sort of go up. It is exponential growth over time, and suddenly you have a wall there. And at that point in time, the internet will die. I have seen these kind of pictures where the point in time was as early as 1994, because that was when IP was going to be dead and we needed OSI. And then IP would be dead as a transport, we needed ATM, that was about 98, 99, and etc. I'm tired of these kind of pictures. So, what world will we get? Well, we have build and keep. The majority of traffic is the best effort. I'm trying to close all my arguments here. Peering and transit agreements do exist between the operators, and customers pay a fixed fee for the bandwidth. And IP-level routing solves the robustness issues. This is something that has evolved during the last 15 years, and it will not change overnight. So we cannot ignore the last 15 years' revolution. I'm a person that do believe in Darwin and that the people tried other things, they died. So Darwin, together with the market economy we have chosen to live in, that world, patches to the model is the future, I think. We will see Lambda management and fast fallback over Lambdas to be able to get down the failover time of the IP level down to the 50 microsecond timing. So maybe we'll see some kind of that some people want. It might be the case that we see some kind of low-level routing redundancy thing on the Lambda side. But on top of that, of course, it will only see IP routing as a fallback mechanism. We will see simple QoS like DiffServ at the known bottlenecks, which might include the peering points between the ISPs. But apart from that, pure IP and management of pure IP on only one IP network is always the cheapest. It has been so for the last 20 years, and it will continue to be there. So this report, which I will talk about tomorrow, actually, is a report that was released yesterday evening in the IT policy and strategy group for the Swedish government. We had a working group that had been working the last 3 years almost on IT infrastructure and broadband, and this report was released yesterday that talks a little bit more about these kind of movements. The URL is as lovely as always. So that's it. Thank you.
So thank you, all the speakers. Come to the stage. Do the audience have any questions? Just raise your hand if you have questions, and the speakers will do their best to give you some answers. Anybody have any question? Okay, in that case, I would just like to deliver some thank you for your speech. And due to Swedish alcohol laws and regulations, I have to give you a little card here, and you go to the registration desk and they will deliver it for you. Thank you for listening.